today. What will a Joe Biden presidency mean for America's relationship with the rest of the world? To understand Joe Biden's view of the world, our diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter, suggests going back to a speech he delivered last year at a major conference in Germany.
And I want to thank Chancellor Merkel once again hosting us, but even more for the speech that she gave this morning.
It was February 2019. Trumpism, in a sense, was in its pomp, and Joe Biden came into this hall at the Munich Security Conference to offer a totally different vision of what America could be and what its relationship should be with Europe.
And I can assure you that the American people, the ultimate wellspring of power in the United States of America, remain committed to engaging the world with decency and respect.
I was sitting at the back of the hall in a lowly position behind many, many thousands of diplomats and military figures. His vision was that America could lead again in Europe, that it would be strong in NATO.
And the support for NATO is one of those rare issues where Republicans and Democrats, two things we can agree on, NATO and the fight against cancer.
And that he felt also the real threat facing America and Europe was from authoritarian states.
America, I see, cherishes a free press, democracy, the rule of law. It stands up to the aggression of dictators and against strong men.
It was a very moving speech, in a sense. He was calling on the best of America not to be forgotten and that it would return.
We will be back. We will be back. Don't have any doubt about that.
And I think the speech had an echo in the hall. But at the same time, there was a kind of concern amongst delegates afterwards that this was slightly full of nostalgia and about a past that was never going to return, about an American leadership role that had really passed its sell-by date.
And yet, 19 months on, those words now firmly represent the future direction of American foreign policy. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does a Joe Biden victory mean for the rest of the world?
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Patrick, we knew Donald Trump's mantra of America first before he became president. What did it actually look like when he was in the White House?
Well, everyone knew that America first broadly was going to be an assertion of American trade interests, economic interests, but no one understood the scale of what was about to happen. He could just shift on a dime on any issue at any point, and that really upsets diplomacy, which very much relies on careful thought before acting.
And within that, one of the things that was very striking was how he seemed determined to almost woo the world's most authoritarian leaders.
Yeah, I mean, right from the very start, I mean, one of the leaders he became closest to was the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia.
A friend of mine, a man who has really done things in the last 5 years in terms of opening up Saudi Arabia, and I think especially what you've done for women.
There was a bizarre faith, for instance, in his personal relationship with the leaders of North Korea. He was sending love letters to them, believing he had this kind of personal electric relationship.
We came over and I said, hey, I'm over here. I want to call up Chairman Kim. And we got to meet, and stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made. A lot of friendships have been made, and this has been in particular a great friendship.
And the same applied to Vladimir Putin. He did a joint press conference with him, and he just refused to criticize him at any point.
I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
And that just contrasted so much with the way in which he dealt with figures like Angela Merkel.
I think what she did to Germany is a disgrace.
or even to a degree with Emmanuel Macron, who wooed him for a long time and then realized no amount of charm, no amount of dining at the Eiffel Tower could bring Trump over.
And in terms of your job, you spend a lot of time going to the big international conferences where different countries try to negotiate with each other. How differently did America operate under Trump in those situations?
America often didn't turn up. I mean, one of the striking things is the number of international institutions they either simply withdrew from or really took no interest in. The absence of American leadership was so apparent also to Britain, because Britain is so dependent on America to know the direction in which its own diplomacy should go.
And what were the actual consequences of that shift, of a once predictable global superpower suddenly behaving as erratically as it did under Trump's administration?
This had a real world impact. For instance, there was no possible agreement internationally on climate change.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
There was no agreement later on how to fight COVID or how to put together the money for an international vaccine.
The federal government will own these vaccine doses. We're buying them.
And recently, I think also you just see human rights as an issue that American championed being trampled in country after country. Dissidents were jailed, journalists were jailed, and I don't think America stood up to that.
Are there areas where Trump gets credit in terms of foreign policy?
Yes, I think in the end, on China, they did take up a stronger position.
Technology is again driving a new wedge between Washington and Beijing. On the heels of banning Huawei, Donald Trump claims the Chinese app TikTok is a threat to national security, and he's imposing strict conditions on any sale to keep it operating in the U.S.
It may have been born out of competitive edge about trade and about technological leadership, but I think in the end they led to a change of positions by a number of European countries who had been much more willing to use Chinese technology in 5G.
China has reacted angrily after the government banned Huawei from the UK's 5G networks amid security concerns.
And then I think, you know, you could argue that in the Middle East and near the end, he's brought around a form of rapprochement between some Gulf states and Israel. That's not something to be ignored.
Tell me about Biden's experience in foreign affairs and what he might do to start repairing some of the damage you've outlined.
Well, he's hugely experienced. He was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and obviously as vice president for 8 years. He understood the international stage and knows many of the people involved on personal terms. I think there's so much low-hanging fruit. You know, you could sort of fill a supermarket quite quickly. The simple things, which is to show up at meetings for America to be there. I think it's obvious that he will very quickly rejoin the World Health Organization. He'll take an active part in the World Trade Organization, which is responsible for overseeing trade disputes. He'll join the UN Human Rights Council, which is another body Trump left. So there's lots to do just in terms of being there.
And he's already started tweeting that America's back on the world stage. So clearly that's very important to him. One of the big things he's going to do is rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. What difference does it actually make for America to be part of that again?
Well, I think it gives the whole thrust of the negotiations, which will end in Glasgow at the end of next year, a kind of impetus that they lacked.
I will join the Paris Accord because with us out of it, look what's happening. It's all falling apart.
It puts a lot of responsibility on all countries to ask themselves what they're going to do in terms of reducing their carbon emissions.
And the Paris Agreement wasn't the only Obama legacy that Trump unwound. He was also very critical of a deal that some see as a centrepiece of the previous administration's foreign policy.
Today, after 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not. A comprehensive, long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Trump has taken a totally different approach. He described the Iran deal as one-sided and laughable, pulled out of it in 2018, upsetting many world leaders. And then just this week, we've had reports of him raising tensions with Tehran again. Apparently, he has considered the option of bombing the country's main nuclear site. It's very different from Biden, who was by Obama's side when the US made that deal. Do you think he'll rejoin it?
I think that's more up in the air at the moment. He's going to have to wait to see what Iran's going to offer. And though he says he wants to rejoin the nuclear deal, the issue is going to be whether there are any preconditions for him doing so, and for whether there are any preconditions set for lifting the panoply of sanctions the Trump regime put on Iran. And Iran itself is probably going to have to resolve how it wants to respond to Biden. I mean, at the moment, they're saying there's no difference between Trump and Biden.
What kind of conversations are being had?
I mean, many Iranians just regard America per se as Satan, and they greatly enjoyed the chaos in America over their elections and said it showed that American democracy was deeply flawed. But there are gradually voices saying, look, we've got to realize this is a new opportunity for Iran. I think in the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, there's a deep knowledge of many of the officials that are likely to join the Biden team, and they have an understanding with one another built up over many years negotiating the nuclear deal in 2015. But they're both very hard negotiators, so I think it could be difficult. They may insist, for instance, that there's a very large financial compensation package given to Iran from America as a result of them imposing these sanctions.
There are other controversial moves by Trump that I'm interested to see what Biden will do about. For example, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
This is a long overdue step to advance the peace process and to work towards a lasting agreement.
Could we expect that to be reversed?
No, I don't think so. There's a number of battles that Biden can fight at once. And if he does decide to have a rapprochement of sorts with Tehran, he's got to limit the number of battles he has with Israel, because Israel will be extremely concerned by any sign that America is getting closer to Iran. So, no, I think he will talk about a two-state solution, and he'll argue against annexation of further lands by Israel. But I don't think a lot of the other issues are going to be undone.
One thing Donald Trump hasn't done, in contrast to other American leaders of the past, is start any international wars. What is Biden's position on foreign intervention?
I think that's one of the most interesting things that's going to emerge over the next year or so. You're right to say that Trump hasn't really engaged in any major wars. He did take military action against Syria over the use of chemical weapons. But he has tried to withdraw troops from Syria. He has tried to withdraw troops from Afghanistan.
Our soldiers are not in harm's way, as they shouldn't be, as two countries fight over land. That has nothing to do with us.
And he's shown no inclination to become closely involved in the civil war in Libya. And I don't think we're going to see American troops being mobilized by Joe Biden. There's a big lobby inside the American Democratic Party that says there has to be an end to endless wars. And I think Biden, if you look at his record, has always been cautious about the use of military force.
Although he did vote for Iraq.
He did, but I think if you look at what he advocated in Afghanistan and in Libya, he was not one of the leading hawks.
Coming up, what will Joe Biden's presidency mean for Brexit? Okay, let's look at this from a British perspective for a minute. Tell me what they've been thinking inside Downing Street.
Well, I think Boris wanted to see Trump return because there had been a very kind of close personal relationship.
It's great to be with my friend Boris Johnson. Just got a position that he's having a very easy time with. It's much easier than he thought.
That mattered to him, that relationship. But the other side of him would have been thinking more broadly is if you look at the interests of America and Britain, they're better allied with a Biden White House than with a Trump White House. So if some of the issues we've been discussing, such as climate change, Iran, the UK would be much more in tune with Biden's thinking than with Donald Trump's. So I think there's this dichotomy between what was in his personal political interests and what was in the UK national interest.
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I had and have a good relationship with the previous president. I do not resile from that. It is the duty of all British prime ministers to have a good relationship with the White House. But I'm delighted to find the many areas in which the incoming Biden-Harris administration is able to make common cause with us.
As usual, political journalists have been obsessing over where we would be in the line of international phone calls. Theresa May was a lowly ninth for Donald Trump, but Biden rang Boris Johnson second. Is there any significance to that?
To be honest, I think it's deeply trivial, but the relationship between America and Britain is such a sensitive stage, and there's so much speculation about it, that it probably did matter where we were in that line of phone calls. And I know it's very sensitive internationally, because I got a message from the Prime Minister's office in Fiji challenging me for having written that the Maldives had been the first country to tweet its congratulations to Biden. The Fiji Prime Minister insisted he had been the first to tweet his congratulations.
Not just political journalists obsessing about this, then?
No. I couldn't believe I'd received this message, to be honest. But all across the globe, it does matter.
Johnson had a strained relationship with Obama at times. When he was not in government but running the Leave campaign, the then president angered Brexiteers by intervening in the referendum.
Soon, because our focus is in negotiating with a big bloc, the European Union, to get a trade agreement done. And UK is going to be in the back of the queue.
And then Johnson bizarrely referred to what he called Obama's part Kenyan ancestry. Biden was his deputy. Does that affect relations?
I think the people around Biden do remember that episode. And in fact, they have been recollecting it, describing Johnson as a scene shifter and a mini Trump.
And it's not just a personal issue, is it? For the UK, what's really important right now is a big policy issue. That Brexit deadline on December the 31st is looming. We don't as yet have a trade deal with the EU. And Biden himself has tweeted his concern about the way talks have been going. He wrote, "We can't allow the Good Friday Agreement that brought peace to Northern Ireland to become a casualty of Brexit. Any trade deal between the US and UK must be contingent upon respect for the agreement and preventing the return of a hard border, period." How significant is that, and how problematic could it be for Johnson?
It was a shock to the Foreign Office when that happened. It happened at a time when the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, was in Washington trying to talk to the Democrats and to the Republicans about the state of the Brexit negotiations. And there was no need for Biden to have made such a full statement such as that. And it underlined the way in which he is very close to the Irish community, both through his own familial roots and politically. He went out of his way to lay down a marker about how far the UK could push the European Union on the trade deal they're going to strike. I mean, they're not going to try and reverse the Brexit decision, but they are certainly going to side with the European Union over the nature of the trade deal. And they're also going to make it absolutely clear to Boris Johnson that he shouldn't try to disrupt the European Union after the trade deal is sealed, or even if it isn't sealed.
Given that the Democratic Party are going to take control again, are we now at the back of the queue, as Obama warned?
On a trade deal with America, it was always going to be difficult to secure. I think if it had been possible to secure it before the elections, it would have been done so. But there are so many difficult issues about pharmaceuticals, about agriculture, that it's simply not possible. And now it's not going to be a priority for the Biden administration. And I think it's quite possible that Congress will redraw the mandate for Biden in June next year on trade. And at that point, the trade deal will die away. And the danger for the UK is they end up without a trade deal with the European Union and without a trade deal with America.
As you've also said, there's a lot where we share common values when it comes to foreign policy. I thought it was notable that in a recent speech to the UN, Boris Johnson was absolutely playing the role of an internationalist, saying that we needed a global response on COVID. And both the UK and the US will have similar concerns about some other countries in the world, including Russia. We know Trump actively courted Vladimir Putin. How will Biden handle that relationship?
Well, I think there's going to be a big theme that's going to run through Biden's presidency, which is about standing up to authoritarianism. And I think Putin represents that more than anyone else.
The fact is that I've gone head to head with Putin and made it clear to him we're not going to take any of his stuff. He's Putin's puppy. He still refuses to even say anything to Putin about the bounty on the heads of American soldiers.
It's been noticeable that Putin has said nothing since Biden was declared a winner. And I think there's going to be less confusion about the American position, because I think actually what you have had in practice was a policy adopted by Donald Trump and then another policy adopted by the rest of the American government, which was much more hostile to Russia.
What about China?
Going back to the Munich Security Conference that we talked about at the start of this conversation, it was really striking the degree to which the Democratic delegation to that conference and the Republican side agreed about the threat posed by China. And it's now become a more coherent hostility to China, because it's about not just human rights, but it's also about trade and the threat to technology and the threat to the internet. I think you're going to see Biden taking a much tougher approach.
Would you allow Chinese firms to build critical U.S. infrastructure?
No, I would not. And I spent more time with Xi Jinping than any world leader had by the time we left office. This is a guy who doesn't have a Democratic with a small D bone in his body.
The trick will be, how does he balance that out with continuing to cooperate with China on issues such as climate change? Because there are many people, including the UK Foreign Office, will say there is no world issue that can be solved without Chinese cooperation.
Does it matter that Biden in the Democratic primary debates described President Xi Jinping as a thug?
Well, that is, you got to a point with Trump near the end that his people were beginning to say similar things. There was very good analysis coming out from the Trump administration about what the Chinese Communist Party represented. It was very similar to the kind of thinking you'd have in the 40s during the Cold War about Russia, that this was an existential threat to democracy. Biden's going to have to choose his words more carefully now that he's outside the primary circus, and he's going to have to think, where is this balance between competition and cooperation?
And you talked about a shift in approach to authoritarian leaders. What are the other examples of that?
Well, obviously he's going to have to pick the number of battles he has at any one time. But if I was the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, I would be concerned about the future relationship and whether, for instance, the security files that the US has on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Istanbul consulate will ever be published, because I think there is a file that probably comes to a very clear conclusion as to who was responsible for his death. At the same time, the US can't throw out all its relationships in the Middle East.
Patrick, we've discussed all of this from a straight foreign policy perspective, and it's pretty clear already that Biden is going to dramatically change the tone. He says America first meant America alone. He doesn't want that. And yet 70 million people just voted for Donald Trump, in part because of that America first promise, because they felt they'd lost out as a result of globalism. Doesn't that mean that it will be difficult for foreign policy to be a priority for Biden? What is he going to do to convince those voters that he is putting their interests first?
Well, I think that's a really good point. Many Democrats thought they were going to eviscerate Trump and Trumpism, and that they would gain control of Congress and the Senate and really be in a position of untrammeled power. That's not happened. I think he's going to try and take on some of Trump's sort of attitude to the industrial base in America and the need to protect it. And he's going to talk about made in all of America. So it's a way of having an industrial trade and economic policy that speaks to the democratic heartlands that he's managed to bring over, and he needs to retain those people. He's also going to have to just concentrate on issues such as fighting the virus and trying to show that government can be effective. And he'll also have to show that he understands the concerns of black people that has been revealed so starkly through the summer. And I think there's a concern that the foreign policy mustn't float off from domestic policy, and that in the past, foreign policy has been something that's been conducted by our Washington elite, what's been called the blob, and that actually it's got to be connected fully with domestic policy.
Patrick Winter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was our diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter. Do go to theguardian.com to read his reporting on all of this. You can also find really interesting articles by our World Affairs editor, Julian Borger. And do follow all the other US stories with our Guardian US team and on the live blog run by Joan E. Grieve. That's it for today. My thanks to Patrick Winter. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.